You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Because we imagine, writes pioneering development psychologist Alison Gopnik, we can have invention and technology, but it's actually play, not necessity, that is the mother of invention. Alison Gopnik is a professor of psychology and an affiliate professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley. She's an internationally recognized leader in the study of children's learning and development and was the first to argue that children's minds could help us understand deep philosophical questions. And those who have spent time with young children, and I assume many, most of you have in this room, have probably experienced just that. It brought to mind talking to my grandniece a few weeks ago, cuddled next to me. We were talking about the complexity and wonders of her family heritage, strands of her family tree from Poland, Russia, England, France, and Gujarat, India. And we were looking at family photos, and then she commented, "And then I'll have children, and they'll have children, and it will go down and down and down and down and down and down and down." So yes, Madam Darwin, so it will. Alison Gopnik writes a column for the Wall Street Journal and is the author of over 100 journal articles and several books, including Words, Thoughts, and Theories, co-authored with Andrew Meltzoff, the best-selling and critically acclaimed The Scientist in the Crib, co-authored with, I think it's also co-authored with Andrew Meltzoff, and Alison can correct me if that's not true, and The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Love, Truth, and the Meaning of Life. Her most recent book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children, in which she draws on the study of human evolution and her own cutting-edge scientific research into how children learn. Tonight we have the pleasure of hearing Dr. Gopnik speak to us about evolution and the young mind, creativity and learning, followed by a conversation with veteran radio host and one of our favorite Aloud interlocutors, Alex Cohen, co-host of KPCC's Take Two, and soon, starting February 13th, the voice of KPCC's Morning Edition. And as I said, after their conversation, they'll take some questions for you. We will circulate microphones in the audience as we do record for podcasts, so please wait for them. And afterwards, Alison will be signing her book in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. So now please join me in welcoming Alison Gopnik to the Aloud stage. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me and for coming out on this bitter cold Los Angeles night. So I'm going to start out today by asking a question that philosophers could have been asking for all of these years, but haven't. And that question is, why is it that we have children at all? Now, not the obvious answer, which probably most people in this room have figured out. When I give talks to the computer scientists in the valley near me at Berkeley, it's not so obvious that they've all figured it out. But the bigger question is, why is it that as human beings, we have this extended, long period of childhood? And it's a really puzzling question because one of the things that was most distinctive about our evolution was this shift in what biologists call our life history. The fact that our children are dependent on us for much longer than those of any other species. So, for example, this is a 7-year-old chimpanzee from Gombe, and by the time they're 7, chimps are actually producing more food, as much food as they're consuming. And if you look even in hunter-gatherer cultures, human children aren't doing that until they're at least 15. And my son is 27, and in some cultures, even at 27... you're still writing rent and tuition checks. Now, why would that be? Why do we have this really distinctive, long, long childhood? And that childhood is not only very long, but it's also very costly. So we've developed also very distinctive adaptations to just keep those helpless children alive for that extended long period. We have fathers taking care of children as well as mothers. We have pair bonding. We have what are anthropologists call alloparents, people who aren't kin who take care of children. We have my personal favorite, grandmothers. Again, other, even our closest primate relatives, don't live past their fertility. So there's something that those children must be doing to be worth all that trouble and investment. And the question is, what is it? And to kind of give away the punchline, what I'm going to argue is that it is, in fact, a device for having creative solutions to problems. And in fact, when you look across many different species of animals, not just primates, but mammals in general, marsupials, notably birds, you see this relationship between how long a childhood an animal has, how relatively large its brain is, and just how plain smart it is. So the kind of poster animals for this relationship are actually birds. So on that side is a New Caledonian crow. These are crows who live off the coast of New Guinea and are as smart, if not smarter in some ways, than chimpanzees, for example. This is a bird who's learned how to bend a wire to make a hook to get food. And on the other side, you have our friend the domestic chicken, and with apologies to any chicken lovers in the audience, this is an apology you have to make when you come from Berkeley. Chickens are basically as dumb as stumps. So chickens are very good at pecking for grain, and they're very good at pecking for grain pretty much from the time they're born. They're not much good at learning new things. The chickens are mature within a few weeks. The crows are fledglings for as long as a year, and these New Caledonian crows, the very smart crows, are fledglings for as long as 2 years. So the question is, why is that? Why do we see this very, very general relationship among lots across many, many different species of animals? And actually looking at what the crows are doing in that period can help to give us some hints. So essentially what the crows do for those 2 years, which at least are not 27, is screw up. So in the wild, these animals use their incredible intelligence to do things like this. They'll take a palm leaf, they'll strip off the bottom leaves, they'll nibble the end of it until it makes a sharp point, they'll stick it in a hole full of termites, move it around to agitate the termites, and pull it out and get a termite shish kebab. It's incredibly intelligent tool use that you see in these animals. So what are the baby crows doing? They're trying and failing. They're putting the barbs on the wrong way. They're chewing it from the wrong end. They're putting it in upside down. But of course, it's exactly that failing fast, as we say down in the valley, that enables them to learn as much as they do. It's exactly that ability to try things, including trying new things that you've never done before, and fail and try again, that's the thing that actually enables these animals to be so smart. And you can see this if you look at brain development, too. Could we have the video? So this is a graph that shows the development of synapses, connections between neurons over development. And what you can see, maybe? Previous one. You should just be able to click. There we go. Yeah, there we go. What you can see is that there's this early period from about 0 to 5 when many, many, many new connections are being formed. And then there's a kind of tipping point when the new connections get strengthened, they become more efficient and more effective, the connections that are used a lot, and other connections are pruned. They just disappear. So even if you look at brain development, there's this contrast between an early brain that's beautifully designed for exploration, for learning, for considering possibility, that's very plastic, as neuroscientists say, that can change very quickly and easily in the light of new experience. And this later brain that's very effective, that can do things very well, that's this kind of lean, mean action machine, but has a lot more trouble changing, has a lot more trouble actually reacting to experience. So this seems to actually be built into this division of labor between an early period where we get to explore and learn because we're being protected and taken care of, and then a later period where we take all the things that we learned when we were young and actually put them to use, that seems to be built into the design of our brains. And again, this early period of exploration is expensive. This is one of my favorite recent facts. You can't quite tell it from this chart. This is a chart that looks at how many calories your brain uses up relative to your general body. So you may know brains are really like other computers. They're really expensive gadgets. So as you're just sitting here right now, your brain is using 20% of your calories. I always feel like if you're thinking deep, important scientific thoughts, it should be using up more, but it doesn't seem to actually work that way. So what they did in this paper was look at how that changes over development. And what they found is that when children are four, their brains are using 66% of the calories that they have. So you can see, just like that chart that I showed you with the brain development, there's this early period when a tremendous amount of energy is being used just to do that wiring of the brain, and then things kind of settle down to something more like an adult picture. I also like this because I think it gives you a wonderful vision of, say, my four-year-old grandson, Augie, which is that he's like this creature out of Doctor Who. He's this enormous, hungry brain with this little tiny body that just goes around the world making everybody into his slaves to feed that brain and keep things, keep feeding that brain and keep it going. But again, this emphasizes the fact that all of us are, from as long as we've been human, one of the main things that we do as adult human beings is find food for those hungry little brains. So what are some of the advantages? If this is true, you might expect to find really powerful, creative, exploratory learning abilities in these very young children. And that's just what I and many other colleagues in developmental psychology have found over the last 30 years. So we've discovered that even the youngest children both know more and learn more than we ever would have thought possible before. They're doing things like taking patterns of statistics, making inferences, figuring out conditional probabilities. That may all sound rather surprising to anyone as an adult who's tried to, say, take a statistics class. How could we even show this in four-year-olds? Well, we do it by giving them real objects to make real inferences about. And one of the objects is this little object, the Blickett detector. This is a box that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it and not others, namely Blickets. And just using this simple machine, we've shown that children are capable of tremendously sophisticated inferences like the very smartest scientists. And now you can actually be participants, as we say, in one of our experiments. Here's one experiment that we do, for instance. You see our Blickett detector. Block D, which is a particular shape, goes on the detector and nothing happens three times. E goes on and nothing happens. D and F go on together and the detector lights up, and it lights up twice. And now here's the question. Is D a Blickett? No? Okay. Is E a Blickett? Is F a Blickett? Okay. So as I would expect, the audience of one of these allowed series is as smart as Berkeley undergraduates, but not as smart as four-year-olds. Because what if you also saw these events first? These are three different blocks. Now you saw that A and C make the detector go, but A and B don't, B and C don't, and A and C by themselves don't. Now you might think, wait a minute, I thought the way that detector worked was that each block either made it go or not. But this one seems to work in this kind of unusual way. You have to have a combination of two blocks to make it go. It has to be A and C together, not just A or C by itself. And if you saw that sequence of events and went back to the one that I showed you before, you might change your mind about whether D was a Blickett. Because if this detector works in this weird, unusual way, it requires this combination principle, then maybe D is a Blickett, and it's really the D and F combination that's making the machine go. Okay. So what we did was we did exactly the experiment that I just did with you, with Berkeley undergraduates and four-year-olds. We either showed them a pattern that suggested that individual blocks made the machine go, the one on the top, or we gave them a pattern that suggested that you needed a combination of blocks to make the machine go, and then we tested them with exactly the pattern that I just showed you. And here's what happened. When we did this with four-year-olds, the four-year-olds would choose the individual pattern when that was the right one, when they had good evidence for it. But they'd choose the combination pattern when they had evidence for that. So like good scientists, they were looking at the evidence and saying, okay, here's how this machine works. When we did this with Berkeley undergraduates, they were very good at finding the obvious answer, the one about the individual objects. But when we gave them evidence that went against that obvious answer, they just went with the obvious answer. So they just stuck with the thing that was the obvious possibility. They didn't actually figure out the other possibility. And let me show you what this actually looks like. Can we have the video? Okay, so I like showing this because, of course, I have a moral obligation as a developmental psychologist to show cute children. But I really like showing it because if you were like me as you were watching this, you were thinking to yourself, what was that? Was that like the triangle went on at the same time as the circle? It's actually really hard, even when you're a grown-up, to track all that series of events. But the four-year-olds, and you could see how focused she was, paying attention to it, extracting it, figuring it out, and coming up with the right creative solution, the right creative answer. And we've recently done these experiments with children in Head Start programs in Oakland and children in poor sections of Peru. And those children are just as good at finding the unlikely solution and just as good at tracking these kind of complicated patterns of events and drawing the right kinds of conclusions from them. We've also done this now over development. So we've done it with six-year-olds, with nine-year-olds, with adolescents, and with adults. And if you look at the developmental curve, it kind of goes down slowly for the 6 and 7-year-olds. And then you hit 12, and it just falls off a cliff and stays there for the rest of your adult life on the finding the unusual solution. So we've now done this with a number of different tasks, and what we find is this general pattern where if you need to find an unusual, unlikely hypothesis, go to a four-year-old. The four-year-olds are actually more likely to be able to solve the problem than at least a Berkeley undergraduate. And let me give you one more example of this. This is from another study that we did. This is with looking at children learning through imitating what other people are doing. And the way we did this was we have another one of our little machines. This is a little toy that plays music. And what you can do is do three different things to the little toy. You squish it, you squeeze the bulb, and you pull the ring, and it plays music. And then you can see another sequence. Now we're going to pull the handle and squeeze the bulb and pull the ring, and the machine plays music. And the question is, what should you do to make the machine play music? Now, if you saw this sequence of events, and this is the BC, that's what you just saw, what you should do if you were really being creative is to figure out that you don't actually have to do just what the person showed you to do. You only have to do the last two actions. So if you just, I can't remember what it was, pull the bulb and push the bulb and pull the ring, you can make it make music. And what we did was actually just show children, can we have the video? We showed children these pretty complicated sequences of events. Okay, so she does this 10 times, each time with a different sequence. I was thinking, this is a very Berkeley-looking child as I was looking at him. He has a Tyrannosaurus Rex and a pretty necklace on at the same time. But here's what he does. So this little boy and the other four-year-olds could figure out exactly the right new solution to the problem based on the statistics of the pattern that they saw. And we had several different kinds of patterns, each with a different kind of statistical solution, and the four-year-olds could figure out those statistical solutions. Now, part of the reason why I've shown you this, though, is because there's an interesting twist. You may have noticed that Daphna, who was actually an MIT computer scientist originally, was very good at being clueless. She was very clueless in that experiment. She said, I don't know, this is a toy. I don't know how it works. Let me just see. And the children were very good at being creative. We did exactly the same experiment. The only difference was that this time Daphna said, this is my toy. I'm going to show you how it works. And when we did that, the children got the creative solution. When we did that, all the children ever did was to imitate exactly what Daphna had done. So already, and there's, again, a number of other studies that show the same thing. So already, these four-year-old children are sensitive to whether or not someone is just giving them information or actually trying to teach them. And they rationally think, if someone's trying to teach me, then I should do what they say and do what they do. So there's a kind of double-edged sword of teaching where, in some ways, of course, it's a great way to get information to children. But it also can have the effect of narrowing this natural exploration and creativity that we see in children. And this has become a practical policy issue because there's increasing pressure on preschools to look more and more like schools. And in some ways, this is exactly the opposite of what our science would tell us, that what's happening in this early period is exactly this kind of exploratory creative learning. So what's the moral? The moral is that, go back to why we have that long childhood, we have that long childhood so we can explore. And computer scientists talk about a difference between exploration and exploitation. If you really want to get creative solutions to things, you need a protected space. You need time to just explore possibilities in a noisy, crazy, random, variable kind of way. And that seems to be what childhood does for us. That's what childhood is all about. So if we want as adults to be more creative, one thing that we could do is try to be more like children. And let me, just as a kind of backdrop for our conversation now, show you this is not really a new idea, if we could have the video. I just recently discovered in the Berkeley Library a silent film from the 1920s of the Child Study Center at Berkeley. And it's hard to remember that kindergarten started out being a child's garden, not a preschool. And even in the 1920s, if you sort of see what these beautiful little children with their 1920s haircuts who are in their 80s or 90s, if they're still alive today, are doing, you can see that having this kind of protected space, lots of love, lots of caregiving, lots of rich geese and bunnies and things like that around, gives you a way of really being able to have this kind of creative exploration and knowledge. And in some ways, we've known that for a long time. Okay, let me stop now, and Alex can come in and we can talk.
Hi. I just want to start off by saying one of the things that I've loved, I've actually seen that presentation, I've watched it a couple times now. When my daughter was just a couple months old, I and one of my mom's groups got this notification, USC Child Development Study Center doing like brainwave studies. You could get a free Melissa and Doug toy. And more than anything, it could get me out of the house, which if anybody here has had a newborn baby, you really want to do that. So I have been going now for years to USC's Child Development. And I've always been somewhat skeptical because I always thought, well, no offense to any Trojans here, but well, the USC graduate students, they're not all that smart because they never seem how to use their own toys. So, oh, what's this? Now I get it. They were really, really smart. It took me a long time to figure that out. And it's good to know that there's this kind of research. I think anybody seeing this presentation and hearing everything that Allison has had to say, it's a pretty easy sell to think that we want our kids to be able to learn in this kind of way. But it's hard to do that in this day and age. And you alluded to at the end, and I'd like to talk a little, I'd like to start here and talk a bit more about it, about all we, you can see, the brain is wired to do this. We are meant to explore in this way, but it seems like there's a million and one factors out there working against us right now. As you look out at the climate right now here in the U.S. in 2017, what do you see as some of the biggest factors here that make it hard for kids to learn in this way?
Yeah, so when the trajectory for writing the book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, was that I started out wanting to write a book about all this new science, but I also became a grandmother and was watching my own children, raising children at the same time. And I was sort of overwhelmed by the gap between what the science was saying and what was actually happening in the lives of caregivers. So, you know, the first thing to say is, of course, the biggest issue is that 20% of American children are growing up in poverty and isolation and don't have the kind of protected caregiving that they need to be able to do this. So that's absolutely the number one issue. But even when you look at middle-class parents, children, you sort of have the opposite problem. So there's this model, which the parenting model, and it's interesting that that very word only showed up for the first time in the 1970s, this model that if only you can just shape your child the right way, this is what I think of as this carpentry model, you can come out with a particular outcome. And you see this in pressure on parents, you see it in pressure on preschools, and it's sort of the opposite of it's the opposite of what the science would actually say, but there's a lot of sort of competitive pressure among parents who justifiably want their children to come out well and think that there's some kind of recipe that they can use to make that happen.
And when you talk about the carpentry model, I'm going to do the shameless plug for you now. The book that I really wish was around when I was a first mom, because it just opened up all sorts of doors for me. When you talk about parents being carpenters, explained in parenting, what does that mean? Break it down.
So there's a model that we all just take for granted. I mean, including me, but which is actually kind of weird, which is that being a parent, being a caregiver, is like a kind of work or like a kind of going to school. So it's a goal-directed activity. You have outcomes. If you do the right thing, you're going to get the right outcomes. And it just seems sort of obvious that that's true. And that's what the parenting industry is all about. But that's not actually a very good description of, I don't think it captures either our real everyday lived experience, which is that we do all this stuff and things happen in completely unexpected, unpredictable ways that we could never have, both for good and for ill, that we could never have thought of. But it also doesn't capture something more profound, which is that the evolutionary scientific story is it's exactly that randomness, that unpredictability, that enables us to explore and to find new things. And the metaphor that I like instead, this gardener model, isn't just because I think the lived experience of providing this safe, protected space where children can explore is a nice vision, like kindergarten. But also because if you think about what you need for a garden, you need diversity. You need the unexpected. You need a system that's complex and variable in order to adjust to a variable environment. So, another way of thinking about the metaphor is our parenting is a bit like having a monoculture in a farm. So it's like we want to make the biggest potatoes, right? You know, the biggest or the most beautiful orchids, but, you know, the biggest, most protected potatoes with the most fertilizer that we can possibly can. And it feels like that's the right way to do it. But anyone who's a real gardener or farmer will tell you that's not really a recipe for success. What we want is something very different. And that's kind of what I'm arguing in the book about our experience as parents. And I think this should be both liberating and this should be liberating for parents. This should be a message that says that a lot of the things that they're anxious and guilty about are not things that they should be anxious or guilty about.
And I actually want to stay there for a moment because I'm curious, as you mentioned, this whole notion of parenting kind of came up in the 1970s. I feel like it's in overdrive right now. And I think especially one of my observations, and see if this rings true with you, is that you have a lot of parents now, and especially women who are they're trying to get careers together first and all the rest of that. So we find ourselves having babies in our late 30s, early 40s, sometimes beyond that. And we've gotten used to this world where we're able to, quote unquote, master everything, right? Like, I'm the best at my job and I know how to do this and I can change the oil in my car and all the rest of it. And then all of a sudden you're presented with this completely helpless creature that poops and cries and all the rest. And there's a million and one books out there telling you this is the way to do it. And you can look at the scientific evidence for cry training, you know, sleep training versus not and all the rest of it. And you just feel overwhelmed. You feel like there has to be a perfect way. And if you don't hit on it, you have failed miserably, whereas you've been able to figure out everything else in your life. Does that sound familiar?
Well, I think part of what happened in the 70s is if you look at most of recorded history, the way that humans figured out how to care for children was by caring for children. So as I mentioned, one of the things that's really a distinctive human piece of human life is these alloparents, this idea that everybody's taking care of children. And older children, for most of history, have taken care of younger children. Now, if you left an 11-year-old in charge of a 3-year-old, you'd be thrown in jail. But that's been the model for most of human history. And part of what that means is you have a lot of 11-year-olds around to help with the 3-year-olds. But what it also means is that 11-year-old has had experience with caring for children and has seen lots of other people have experience. Really, for the first time in history, in the late 20th century, we had exactly the situation you describe, where someone could be 40, not ever have really cared for a child. Nowadays, you don't really even have teenage babysitters very much anymore, but have been very good at doing things like working and going to school. I actually had an interesting conversation with my 27-year-old, who's actually marvelous and wonderful, independent, great. And he had just spent a week taking care of the grandchildren, so his nieces and nephews. And he said, you know, Mom, I think the things you say in your book, there's a really important point, which is, you know, when you're in your early 20s, you're really crazy. And that's kind of like the same state that you're in after you've taken care of children for 6 days. He said, you know, like when I was starting college, I was staying up all night. I was kind of off in this weird, crazy mode. And, you know, like a week with those three kids under 5, that's pretty much the way I felt. But then, you know, now, 10 years later, you start having this sober life where you go to the gym a lot and you, you know, organize and work. It's not good preparation for being a parent. You're better off thinking of it as being kind of like being a freshman, which is, I think there's something insightful about that. You need that freshman craziness to be able to do that job.
And the ability to get by no sleep whatsoever, yeah. Which precipitously declines. I want to see that chart. If you, you know, when you talk about kindergarten and really what that meant and putting the garden back in kindergarten, it makes me think about, and I don't know what the climate is like in Berkeley these days, but I know having just gone through right about this time last year, my family was in search of the perfect kindergarten, mm-hmm. which in this town can be insane, really yeah. insane yeah. And grossly competitive. And it reminds me of this moment I went on, I think, 13 school tours, which, by the way, is a low number these days to go on between the charter schools and the publics and the privates and all the rest of it. And I was at one school, and the principal said, "I bet you've been hearing a lot about teaching the whole child." And all the parents are nodding their heads, "Yes, the whole child." I said, "Okay, so what school only teaches part of a child?" And then we kind of all in the audience had this, "Oh, yeah." And I realized that I had been to schools that were night and day opposite from each other, but they were all saying the same things.
Yeah.
We're teaching the whole child. What can we as parents look for in a school to actually see that they're on board? Because I feel like there's a certain talk, and then there's what you can see in the classroom, and that's really different. How do you look for a school, if you're buying into this gardener approach, that's going to treat kids more like the wild peony as opposed to a piece of wood to shape into a nice table?
Well, my grandson goes to a wonderful school in Berkeley, and his mom and dad said after the first week, "You know, it seems like there's an awful lot of time that kids are running around without any clothes on in the yard in that school." And I said, "Oh yeah, that's a good sign. That's good. That's a good, you know, just sort of start out with that." So I think the idea that you've got a lot of richness and a lot of messiness at the same time, one of the things that I say in the book is the being in praise of mess. You know, one mm-hmm. thing that you can say about children for sure, incontrovertibly, is that they are messy and the process of taking care of them is messy. We think of that as being a bug, but from an evolutionary perspective, that's actually a feature. It's actually that messiness, that kind of unpredictability that's part of what you want. So now this may also be somewhat personal, but I think finding a place where there's a reasonable amount of disorder that turns into orderliness at the end of the day is one. And of course, the other thing, which we all take for granted, but again, I think this should be liberating, is love. So what this model suggests is it's the caregiving part, which in some ways is the easy part, is love, affection, people, you know, beaming when they see the children come, people putting their arms around the children. Again, there's even pressure against that in the culture at the moment. Yeah. Those are the things that I think you're going to see. But I think, you know, it's a bit frustrating because if you'd seen the rest of that film, that's from 1920, it's not like we don't know how to do this. We have lots of good models. We have the Reggio Emilia model in Italy. Yeah. If you go to most of Europe, you'll see early childhood, which in many places increasingly runs until 7. So in places like Finland and now in Scotland, they have an early childhood program that actually runs till about 7 before you actually start school. Mm. We have Montessori programs, which come with a particular formula, but really what they're doing and Reggio Emilia is doing and the best place like the Child Study Center is doing is providing this kind of rich space with adults who are attentive and paying attention. And I think if you, you know, looked in a forager society, that's pretty much what you'd see too. Mm. Some of you may have seen this wonderful film, Babies. Have people here seen that? And it's really striking. You look at the child growing up in Namibia and the child growing up in Mongolia, and they're in these very rich settings with lots of people around and lots more animals than we have. One of the things I say is if you ask a scientist, what is it that young children really need? They need mud, livestock, and relatives. Those are the three things. And, you know, preschool, you can't quite, in our culture, have a lot of mud, livestock, and relatives, but you can have a guinea pig in a cocoon and loving, attentive preschool teachers and a sandbox.
To do a shameless plug for another book, there's actually a really fascinating book that came out not too long ago called Let Them Eat Dirt. And I love that you say get messy, because there's actually also like a biological physical case to be made that kids today, all the antibiotics that are out there, it is important to get messy in that extent. Some of these other points, as you mentioned, giving them love. Look, I grew up during the McMartin preschool era, and I know that sometimes, you know, things can get really messy and complicated. You talk about having an 11-year-old, you know, care for a young child. Think about, does everyone remember the free-range family that in the mom in Maryland, I believe, was in the D.C. area, whose kids were taken away by the police because she said, and she had to make them badges that say, my mom knows that we're walking home from the park. There's the balance of security, safety, with freedom. How do we walk that line in 2017?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge, but I think there's an increasing perspective that it's really tipped over in the direction of a kind of fearfulness and a kind of over concern with danger that at least seems not to have been true for most of history. And I was just at a conference where I was talking to a bunch of anthropologists. And it's kind of funny. I had done one of my columns in the Wall Street Journal that was actually about that film. And a little later on in that film, the kids, so I'm sitting there saying, isn't this marvelous? What a wonderful preschool. What a great example. I'll show this in all my talks. And then about halfway through, the kids get hammers and nails. The teachers come out with hammers and nails and saws. And the kids start sawing, you know, sawing wood and hammering and nails. And I'm sitting there saying, my God, how do they get through licensing? This is three-year-olds, and they're giving them hammers and nails and saws. And I wrote, at the same time, there was a piece by an anthropologist called Playing with Knives that appeared in the journal Child Development that was about, well, what do you find when you look at ethnographies? You find that 2- and 3- and 4-year-olds are being given knives to play with over and over and over again across all these different societies. So I wrote a column that I was quite nervous about where I said, well, of course you wouldn't actually want to give children knives to play with. I'm not recommending that, but it is kind of striking that this is what happened. And in the journal, I got all of these comments. I thought I'd get all these comments from people saying, how could you say this? Instead, I got comments from all these people who were in their 70s and 80s in rural America who said, well, of course, you know, if you want a knife, you want a sharp knife, not a dull knife. That's the danger isn't sharp knives, it's dull knives. And all these stories about growing up and learning. And when I talked to anthropologists, they said, yes, this is true. And I said, well, are kids like missing fingers? And they said, no, sort of surprising. They don't end up missing fingers. But that depends on having people who are competent and know what they're doing and have confidence in the children. I can tell my own Berkeley story when my son was in high school. They were going on a school trip, and the bus didn't show up. So my son said, all right, well, look, we could just take a city bus, and here's the route. We could just take a city bus and get there. And one of the other kids, I said, I think there would be liability issues about that.
You know, that reminds me of, there was a coffee table book on playgrounds of the 70s and 60s. And it was fascinating because they had, does everyone remember like the Wheel of Death? They see, right? And they literally were called that, and you can't find them anywhere anymore. And this photographer went to all these different places, mostly in like Utah and Arizona, and took pictures of playground structures that you will not find in LA or Berkeley or any place anymore. But what they had noted was that, you know, there was this trajectory of all the really seemingly unsafe playgrounds. And then there were all these lawsuits because the occasional kid broke his arm, what have you. And so they redesigned them. And now there's that, has anyone been to a playground lately? And you know that the spongy, I don't even need to say it, everyone's nodding their head, right? The spongy foam, which sounds great, but they were talking about how kids lose their sense of risk. Because it was like they didn't know when they could jump up from more kids were actually breaking their legs because they didn't know about risk anymore. Is that part of the value of it?
I think it's a very tricky, you know, it's a tricky question because we've always had to adjust to whatever the environment is that we grew up in. And that's one of the things that this exploration enables us to do. And when we're in an environment like ours, maybe part of that adjustment is thinking about, you know, thinking of, if the people around you aren't like people in our in my family would not be very good at sawing and hammering. Well, except for my son, who's actually a carpenter. But and there may be some cycles that are going on there. So you need to have a circle of people around. You need to have kids where there's enough people around who are invested, who can watch, who can help to guide what it is that the children are doing. And the question is, how could we recreate something that's like that? Mm. And you know, I think the main moral that comes out of developmental psychology is this moral of variability and unpredictability. So there's remarkably little predictability from what someone's life is like. Well, let me put it this way. There's a lot of predictability about whether you're in a safe, nurturing setting or not and how you come out. But given that background, there's very little evidence that things like whether you do sleep train or you don't sleep train, mm-hmm. or whether the stroller goes to the front or the stroller goes to the back, or whether children are sleeping with their parents or they're not sleeping with their parents. There's very little evidence that any of that makes much difference in the long run. And there's much more variability and unpredictability than there is continuity. And, you know, marvelous, dedicated parents can have children who screw up in all sorts of ways, and children can grow up in horrible families and become heroes. And that's part of the point. One of the things that I say in the book is, if there isn't a chance that your children can really seriously screw up as adults, you haven't done your job as a parent, because your job as a parent is to make a creature who's autonomous enough that they can go out and take risks. And it's not a risk unless something bad could happen.
But that's a very hard sell,
right? I mean, it's a terrible, it's a hard sell, but I think it's also something that speaks to our heart. I mean, part of what makes caregiving so profound, and I also talk about the evolutionary origins of this in the book, is that we're designed, and I think this is kind of the flip side of the unpredictability and variability, is we get this child, and at least most of the time, we're just completely in love and dedicated to that child. It's not like we're out there saying, okay, let's find the children that are most likely to come out well, and we'll put a lot of investment in those ones, and the ones that are difficult, you know, we're going to not pay so much attention to them. That's not true. You just get this child, and you're completely dedicated to that person, and that's why that caregiving love is so profound. And, you know, sometimes those children are sick or they're disabled. I talk in the book about this a wonderful column by a woman in the Times who had a child who had a disease that meant that he was going to die by the time he was 6 or 7 years old. It's not like you don't care in those circumstances. It's not like you'd say, oh, look, she failed. That wasn't really good caregiving. That caregiving is more intense, a better example of what caregiving is all about. So again, I mean, I think there's something, and I think just in terms of both science and lived experience, that's a much better description of what the relationship is like than this kind of, you know, we're out there to have a particular outcome, and here's the recipe that will let us get there.
Allison, I want to ask about how you talk to your kids about this. Because I feel like there are, you know, if there's a kid who knows how to ask about liabilities when he's 7, yeah. Right? Kids understand this. I am thankful that my daughter's kindergarten teacher is here tonight, and she shared a story with me the other day that I just found, I can't shake it. And she said, my daughter, who really loves writing, was spelling all these words and kept asking her teacher, as she asked me all the time, how do you spell this word and how do you spell that word? And because my daughter goes to a wonderful school, they said, well, you know, why don't you explore? How would you want to spell it? What does it sound like to you? And my daughter, and I can picture this because she's just as willful and stubborn as I am, her head kind of started to explode. But no, but how do you spell it? And now this may well could be both of her grandmothers are English teachers, so I think there might be genetic coding within her to want to know the exact answers. But I realized that it would be helpful for me to be able to explain to her, here's why it's okay. Mm-hmm. If you don't know how to spell this word, or you spell it wrong, or you bomb a test, or you crash a car, or whatever it will be, those failures, per se, growing up. How do you talk to your kids about them and make them understand that it's okay?
Yeah. Well, look, I should say, it's not as if I have any, in terms of my own caregiving, I have any insight to give in terms of, my only piece of advice that I'm willing to give is, skip the children, go straight to the grandchildren. That would be my one. That's my one piece of actual wisdom. And maybe the other, my sort of three word summary is you love them and muddle through and hope for the best. That's I think that's probably the best description that you can have of how they're going to come out. I actually have a funny story about my grandson. I was going into give this talk to his preschool, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to go in and talk to all the teachers at your school." And he said, "That's nice, Grandma. I can talk to the teachers myself." So he is not having any of Grandma being an expert about this.
Well, to stay with my daughter's spelling woes for a moment, the more I thought about it, I said, where did this come from, this idea that she had to get it right? And then I realized that in large part it's because, I think, of devices and technology. She is taken to occasionally pilfering my phone or my husband's phone and texting. The first time she did this, she texted the brand new male receptionist at my work, "I love you," to call him and explain that I had not sent that. But I realized she's growing up in a world of autocorrect where she knows one of the first words that she spelled for me was "Mom, barnacle spelled B-A-R-N-A-C-L-E." What the hell was that? You went from cat to barnacle. But she's surrounded by technology, more so than I ever was or you ever were or kids born 2 years ago ever were. And I know a lot of us really fear the role that technology is playing in our lives, certainly our kids' lives. You do a great thing in this book that has got me feeling way better about it than anything else, but I don't want to spoil it. Will you explain it and share your thoughts about technology and how it factors into all this?
Let me start out with an apocalyptic technology tale. So here's a vision. Here's a child who, when she's 2-3 years old, gets given this device, and the effect of the device, it has really powerful optical interface, and it takes her off into this completely alternative reality. And actually, psychologists have studied it, and they've discovered that it actually reshapes her brain as a result of interacting with this device. And by the time she's 6 or 7 years old, she could spend 4 hours completely oblivious of all of the people around her, not having any social interactions, just being caught up by the device. And by the time she's an adult, a lot of her imagination of the world actually comes through the device, not through the real world, to the point where every room in her house has the device in it. And this is a really terrible story. Her child breaks his leg, speaking of breaking legs, playing hockey, and the first thing she thinks as she's going to the hospital is, "Do I have the device with me? Do I have the device with me?" And then she gets her kids hooked too. All right, well, that story is autobiography, because the device is the book. And one of the things that we know is that reading completely reshapes your brain. Big chunks of your brain that were originally designed for other things are now being devoted to print. You can't avoid reading. You're captured as soon as you see print. If you're an adult who's read for a long time, you're captured by print. If someone were to describe books now as a new technology, we would all be saying, "What a horrible thing! They're antisocial and they..." And in fact, Socrates famously said that. He said books were terrible because they would mean that no one would memorize Homer anymore, and people wouldn't have conversations because they would just think that everything that was in a book was true. And he was right, right? We don't memorize Homer anymore, and we do tend to believe that things that are in books are true, but we feel as if that trade-off was in the long run worth it. And my guess is that that's what's going to happen with new technologies as well. Maybe this time will be different from all the other times. But I think there's actually an interesting kind of neurological story here, which is that whenever you're trying to master, and this goes back to what I was talking about in my talk, if you're trying to master a new technology with that late brain, that brain that's very well connected and not very plastic, it's very effortful. It requires a lot of attention. You're, as I think all of us are, you're distracted a lot of the time. But if you're mastering that technology with that young brain, the way that you are when you're learning to read, for example, then you're not using attention in the same way. You're actually being able to extract information from the technology in a more spontaneous way. And it's kind of interesting. When I wrote the book, I thought, boy, this is going to get me in trouble. I'm really out there in the world at large. But increasingly, there's just a piece that came out in the journal Psychological Science. There was just an open letter in The Guardian. If you talk to people in psychological science, the general picture, the American Institute of Pediatrics just put out a new bunch of guidelines as a result of a lot of studies, is that it's about content and context, the same way it is with books, that what matters is what the devices are, what the content of the devices are, what the context is. You can have things that are mindless and violent, and things that are mindless and violent are mindless and violent and bad, and you can have things that are that extend your vision of the universe and are full of extra information. In fact, I just did a piece in The New Yorker. It was the week after the election, so I don't think anyone, including me, was paying any attention to it. But one of the things that I described, again, is a story with my beloved Augie, where we were out in the garden, and I was being a good garden grandmother, and there was a bee, and I said, "Oh, Augie, bees make honey." And he said, this is also very Augie, "Beat, beat, beat. Grandma, how do bees make honey?" All right, then I'm thinking, do I have any idea how bees make honey? I mean, I know they make honey, but okay, so they have nectar, I know that, but how does that turn into honey? So I had my phone, and I said, "Augie, I don't know." And he said, "Well, you have your phone," which sort of means you know, right? So I looked it up, and it turns out that, you know, there's this enzyme called invertase that the bees use. My favorite part of the story is that they actually flap their wings to evaporate the water, and that's why honey is thick and nectar isn't. Did anybody here know this, right? We went inside. We watched these amazing bee cams. So it turns out that you can actually, beekeepers have this sort of competitive beekeeping videos of their swarms, and then we saw a documentary on the waggle dance that the bees do. So after an hour, I actually knew how bees made honey, and there's no way on earth, I was trying to think even 10 years ago, if Augie had asked me how bees made honey, would I have really gone to the library and gone out and found all the bee books?
We're at the library, you're supposed to say yes.
Yeah, well, that's a good, I might indeed have gone to the library, but I might also have looked up the library. So, you know, there are certainly awful things that kids could be doing with technology, but I think there are also examples like that, where technology really extends our understanding of the world. And I think that's more and more the picture. The Institute of Pediatrics, I think, had a very good description of it, which is it wasn't clear to begin with whether they should be thinking about screens, say, as being like cigarettes, where they're basically bad for you in any amount, or should you think of them as being like food, where there's a level at which they're bad for you, but you also need them, and the trick is to try and figure out what the right diet is, that's going to be effective. And increasingly, I think that kind of food metaphor, that diet metaphor, is more and more what people are arguing for.
I want to turn to the audience and ask you all a couple of questions, and in a few moments, we're going to open up for you to ask questions of Allison. So here's question number one. Everyone be really honest here. How many people knew how honey was made before Allison gave the answer? All right, very good. How many people were guessing the book when she was talking about that really controversial device? Oh, well done. Well, of course Louise did, right? But I read that passage, and that was one of my aha moments out loud, because I was like, oh, she's talking about the TV. She's talking about, you know, phones or something, and it was the book. There's one more real aha moment where I literally out loud was chuckling, and I want to test it out on this audience. And I think everyone's going to get the answer. So cast all your shyness aside and everyone sing with me. Ready? John and Mary sitting in a tree. Thank you. We all know that. There are younger people here. There are older people here. I'm sure there are people born and bred in Southern California, people who didn't grow up in this country. Allison, why do we all know this song?
Yeah.
And why is this important more than anything now that I've made everyone humiliate themselves?
I do this at the beginning of my developmental psychology class. I have this series of three or four of these things that are these sort of transgressive school-age things. Nobody, you know, like your mom didn't teach you. Your mom might have taught you nursery rhymes, but she probably didn't teach you the K-I-S-S-I-N-G one. And again, this is part of this idea about children being designed to create new cultures. And part of what is our distinctive human capacity is that each generation to a little or smaller or greater extent, reshapes the environment that we grow up in. And that's one of the things that makes us really distinctive. So we're always kind of creating this new world. And when you look at school-age children, and I talk about school-age children and adolescents in the book, they have this amazing ability to create this little universe. It's just the private school-age universe. But it's like a little mini culture, all the things that we need to do to make a culture, make stories and make rhymes and make things that make us distinctive from other people. All that's happening in the context of, say, a schoolyard. One last thing that I mentioned that when we do those machine experiments, the adolescents kind of drop off the cliff. But we did a different version of that experiment that was about social relationships. It was about why people did the things that they did. And what we discovered, really much to our surprise, was that when you look there, the 4-year-olds are very good at thinking of new social possibilities. The 6-year-olds are much less good. Then suddenly, about 14, suddenly you're incredibly good again. And then, as an adult, you stop. So if you're looking at the social world, the adolescents don't, you know, like, who cares about how machines work? But when you're introducing new social concepts, the adolescents seem to have this new, and there's some interesting neuroscience about this too, there's like this extra burst of plasticity and possibility and learning in adolescence, but it's all oriented towards figuring out how the social world works and figuring out new social possibilities. So the optimistic thought is that the young are always the ones who are kind of at that edge of where the species is going to go next.
We've spent so much time talking about kids, but my last question to be about grown-ups, and you write, and you spoke earlier tonight about the value of play and capping into kind of that exploratory, able to solve different problems mind, and how we see that in Silicon Valley. You know, why do they have ping pong tables at Google? Yeah. It's kind of to get back to that. There is a lot going on in this world right now, and certainly in this country right now, and I think there are a lot of people who would love to be able to look at the world and find creative solutions to problems. How do we do that in our everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's one of these interesting trade-offs. There's a marvelous book that just came out by Stephen Johnson called Wonderland that also came out right after the election. But he makes this really interesting point, which is that necessity is not the mother of invention. It's usually play that is. So if you look at one of the lovely examples, if you think about the keyboard is in harpsichords for 200 years before anybody thinks about using it for something useful like making a typewriter. And he just has example after example where new ideas come from games and from toys and from things that you wouldn't, where you don't sort of feel the pressure of actually getting a particular outcome. And it's that kind of trade-off that we're seeing in the evolutionary arguments about what the children are doing. But it's a difficult trade-off for adults, because adults need to be able to do both those things. We need to be able to switch flexibly between this is what has to be done now to here's what we can do more generally. But one thing I would say is I wrote a column for the journal right after the election about studies that show that one of the things that fear does is to cut down that exploration. There's even neurological kinds of studies. So this was a study looking at mind wandering, looking at that ability that we have to just have one idea after another that seems to be, again, very, very distinctive human ability. And the way that that gets shut down when people are frightened, that's one, because in a state of fear, you just want to make sure that you get the good close solution. And it's only when you're in that kind of state as a child of feeling protected that you can play and explore. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how it is that you can manage to finesse that trade-off, but I think it's one of the things that adults can do. And we do know some things that you can do. You can travel, you can meditate, you can... My own personal favorite is spend time with children. Spending time with children is a funny example, because in some ways it's the most grown-up thing that we have to do. And in other ways, we get to actually be there in that universe of wild, crazy exploration, at least for a little while, by being caregivers.
I'd like to open it up now to members of the audience. If you have a question, raise your hand. We've got some microphones that'll be coming around. We're not done yet. We're not done yet.
First question. I work in a fairly creative field, and I thought about creativity somewhat. And I think that the difference in my childhood and my kids' childhood is my parents never worried if we were bored or not bored. And I got the feeling that some creativity comes from boredom, just out of having to come up with something to entertain yourself with. And since so much of kids today, I think especially boys, would have to do with entertainment that was programmed for them, where it's someone else's creativity that they're, you know, borrowing if they're looking at a game or doing something like that. And I was just wondering what you thought about, say, borrowed answers to boredom or creativity versus when kids have to come up with their own, go create their own world or their own narrative to play within versus going into a you know, a video game or someone else's narrative to play in.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, I think it's, as far as I could tell, every generation always thinks the next generation is going to hell. That's kind of also part of the, that's also part of the program. Exactly how they go to hell differs from generation to generation, however. You know, I certainly think that giving children's natural curiosity comes out in situations in which they have to explore. They have to be able to do some exploration themselves, and you want them to be able to do that. On the other hand, I'm not so convinced that if we were looking at what children are doing, we say inventing games, or what they're doing in the space of computers, that we wouldn't see some of that independence. It's just that we don't understand the context in which that's happening. But I agree that to some extent leaving children alone is one of the things that's hard to do and that we could do more of. Do we have any women who have questions, by the way? Maybe we could, yeah. Maybe after this one, yeah. I've had this experience now, and I started out being sort of self-conscious about it, but now I've discovered it's amazing that in an audience that's at least half women, almost always the first three questions are from men. So now I've started explicitly asking for women to ask the questions.
You've made me feel bad, but I'll take it anyway. We chose Summerhill for our kid in the 70s because of the science of child development at that time said there was an optimal time for learning certain skills in a child, especially during the first 5 years where the major development of the brain circuits occur. And I'm wondering if you thought that's still true and if technology kind of ignores that in the development and teaching of children.
Well, I think the evidence is that the first 5 years is a really important time when children are learning an enormous amount. In the early period, even someone like the great psychologist Jean Piaget thought that children had to do that through very immediate experience, through their kind of sensory and perceptual experience. And it is true that children are learning a tremendous amount from their immediate sensory and perceptual experience, but I think part of what we've discovered is that even, as in the examples I gave with the Blicket detector, even very young children are also making much more abstract kinds of inferences and ideas. And I think really what's happening is that children are figuring out the things that are important for them to figure out in the environment in which they find themselves. So I think the challenge is to give children access to the things that are going to be important in the environment to the people around them. That doesn't mean you just let children alone or you just let children do whatever they want or you don't give them information. Part of the job of each generation of parents is one of the things I start talking about in the book is I think part of why caregiving is so profound but so difficult is that it's got all these tensions built into it. And one of the tensions is our job is to pass on our values and what we think is important and our accumulated knowledge. That's, again, part of this sort of human cultural program. We take on everything that we've done and we pass it on to our children, and it's hard and we want to do it. And we do that fully knowing that they'll reject half of it and they'll overturn the other half and they'll modify it and they'll come up with something completely different. And that's the point. That's exactly the reason why we want to pass on that information and give them our values. So again, I mean, we are teaching them. We're letting them know what our life is like and what our values are like and what our knowledge is like so they can take that knowledge and values and do something new and unprecedented with it.
Yeah. I'm really interested in your ideas around the similarity between current technology and reading. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because what I observe is that for children under five, reading is actually a social interactive experience. They're reading with someone, and it's relationship as opposed to what I see a lot these days of very, very young children just being handed an iPad or a phone. So they do seem really different to me.
Well, you know, each technology, each generation's way of interacting with each other and with the world is different, and each set of children has to figure out how to cope with that difference. I think the data, the research, are much less pessimistic than people's kind of everyday intuitions are. And as I say, I mean, I think if you look at television. I mean, you know, one of the things that my brother was talking about that's sort of funny that we found ourselves doing is saying to the children, get off the screen, just go and watch some television instead, you know. Get off the computer and go and watch TV. If you look at the Telegraph, you know, it's easy to find editorials in the Times that said how the Telegraph was the end of civilization as we know it. In fact, I give the example in the book. We forget. I mean, think about the train and the telegraph. The train and the telegraph were much more revolutionary changes in our relationship to each other and to the world than anything that's happening in current technology. You went from having the fastest you could go be a fast horse to being able to communicate at the speed of light, right? But of course, none of us would think, oh my goodness, when we get into a train, we're doing this amazing, strange thing, or if we don't even send telegrams anymore, but if we got a telegram, that would be a high level of technology. So I really do think we need to keep in mind the fact that for every generation, one of the ways I put it in the book is I think the year before you were born is always Eden, and the year after your children was born is always Mad Max. That's kind of I think that's a general human trait. But of course, also part of our responsibility is to make sure that whatever technology it is that we have, we use it in as responsible and productive a way as we can. I mean, let me give you one example in the social interaction, very interesting study that came out just recently. Probably I see a lot of people who I think are probably grandparents like me, and we Skype with our children. A lot of us have grandchildren who are far away. And there were studies early on, and there are good studies that show, for instance, that children have a really hard time learning language from video. So if you just watch a video screen, this is the point you were making without social interaction, children won't learn in the same way they do with social interaction. A very interesting new study showed that if you're Skyping, if you have an interactive chat with grandma, children learn in the same way that they do if grandma is actually there. So there's an example where the technology actually enables us to interact socially in a way that we couldn't have interacted socially before. So I think you're absolutely right. Social interaction is really important. The question is, how do you make social interaction happen in the context of a new technology in the same way that we have in with our previous technology?
If I can tack on one example, I noted earlier my daughter knew how to spell barnacle, and we couldn't figure out why, because it's not like we've got posters that say barnacle in our household. She'd been watching the show The Octonauts, and she'd figured out how to turn on closed captioning. That's how she knew barnacle.
Next question.
Have you done any studies, comparative studies, between our society here and perhaps the Chinese mm-hmm. and Japanese, who are much more regimented in their teaching?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So we have been doing cross-cultural studies. I mentioned we've been doing studies in Peru, and we've also done some studies in China and Singapore. And when you look at cultural differences, it's interesting because the dimensions are really different. So in some ways, those cultures are more regimented, but in other ways, there's more of a sense that what children and parents are doing are going to be sort of similar, that children and parents are going to be on the same page. So I think it's hard to say. I'm not sure regimented is quite the right word. It is true that in those cultures, there's a kind of assumption that everyone is going to be more on the same page than that they're all going to be separate individuals. And we have done some work showing that. But within that tradition, you can see some of the same back and forth between one generation and the next generation.
Hi. You mentioned before about how 11-year-olds used to watch 3-year-olds and now you'd get in jail. One of the interesting things that came up recently was a mother posted a picture of her kid doing a chore, and there was this huge backlash about that. And someone mentioned boredom, and I told my daughter when she was like 4, you know, if you come to me and say you're bored, I'm going to give you a chore. And so now when kids come over to our house, she says, don't tell my mother you're bored. She'll give us a chore. We'll figure something out, right? Which is great. And so my question to you is, in terms of the research and chores and independence, can you give us some thoughts around that? Because I think they're all very connected with independent play and all that sort
again,
of stuff.
Again, if you're thinking about the cross-cultural examples, one of the biggest differences that you see across cultures, and our culture, again, is really an outlier, is how much children, especially when they're about 5 or 6, are actually engaged in doing useful things in the culture. So, again, most of recorded history, most of the time, by the time you're 6 or 7, and in some ways I think this is kind of a natural agenda for 6 and 7-year-olds, is to become competent, is to actually start having skills, start to be able to do things that are useful. And chores are an example of those kinds of skills. I think there's an interesting kind of transition around 6 connected with those brain maps that I showed you where, you know, early on, if Georgie, who's my 3-year-old, is helping me cook, it's not really helping very much. It's making everything take much longer than it would otherwise. It's kind of like it's playing, but that's a kind of play that the kids love, right? I mean, there's nothing that kids, especially preschoolers and then up till, say, sort of 6 or 7, like more than being engaged in an activity that the parents around them are engaged in that they're serious about. And one of the things, again, in the transition that I think is really makes life difficult for caregivers is that this sense that you need to be doing this thing, which is the parenting thing. And of course, it's difficult because there's all this other stuff you have to do. You have to cook and do laundry and, you know, do shopping. And how do you find the time to put the parenting in? And I think one of the things that the science says is that having children be engaged in most cultures at most times in most places, the way you've taught children is by having them be engaged in the things that you were serious about doing anyway. And that can be really different in different households with different people with different values. But, you know, I think things like cooking with kids or digging in the garden, which also has the advantage of having lots of mud and mess, or being involved and engaged in just going out to the shops together. Those are all just simple things that people can do at the same time that they're really doing something. They're really taking care of their own lives at the same time, as opposed to this idea that there's this really separate realm, which is the stuff that you do with your kids, as opposed to having your kids be part of the culture and community that you're in. I actually have a nice example of this in technology. So I got back from Budapest a couple of weeks ago, which is a marvelous, wonderful place. And Georgie, who's my 3-year-old, was over, and I said, okay, we'll make strudel. Making strudel is a fabulous, wonderful thing to do with kids. It's messy, and it's interesting, and you end up in lots of different pieces. And I said, this is something that you do in Hungary. We should have violins. And we found, and I said, in Hungary, you'd be having gypsy violins. And she said, well, we could play gypsy violins. You have your iPhone. So we looked up, you know, gypsy violins on the iPhone, and there's all these wonderful YouTube videos of gorgeous guys with mustaches playing gypsy violins. So we made strudel, which is very tactile and wonderful, and we listened to gypsy violins on the iPhone and watched people. We had our little gypsy orchestra as we were doing strudel. So I think that's an example of how you could have both things. You can have a sense of the tactile, and then the technology doesn't necessarily have to be in conflict with that. That's also where I found my strudel recipe.
Hi, I really loved what you had to say. So many wonderful things to contemplate and think about. But I was also thinking about, again, this marriage of technology and the tactile. And I've been doing a lot of reading on the brain and looking at the deep thinking and the cognitive aspects of using print versus digital. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what your thoughts were about that.
Well, as I say, the interesting thing is there's a lot of evidence that print, you know, again, it's kind of interesting. We just take for granted that we read. But if you were looking at the brain and you didn't know that we had invented reading, we would say there seems to be like big chunks of our brain that have just been designed to be dedicated to print. So our brains clearly are really reshaped by practices like reading. And that means that those particular kinds of skills that come with reading, like having a relatively narrow focused attention, those are things that kind of all go together in a particular package. For most of history, for example, I mean, I think this is a good example, the idea that you should have very focused attention on just one thing at a time, if you look in forager societies, caregivers will actually actively try to divide the attention of their children. Because the idea is if you're doing something like going hunting, you don't want to just be focusing on one thing. You want to be open to lots and lots of information. And people will actually be trained to have a broader kind of attentional scope. So if a child's just playing with one toy, a mom will come and put another toy in the other hand so that the child's actually dealing with both of those toys at the same time. That's really, really different from what happens once you have print. And that may be very different from what will happen in the future when we have print as only one of the many forms of technology we have. On the other hand, I think it's worth pointing out something that's actually really curious and that people don't mention very much, which is I've asked people, it's hard to think of a human medium of communication that lasted for long enough to really be a medium of communication that disappears. So we still have theater, we still have dance, we still have poetry, we still have song, we even still have books and television. It's not, you know, the picture we usually have is, oh, this technology is going to come in and it's going to get rid of all the things that we valued from before. And I just don't think empirically that's typically what happens. What happens is each way of understanding the world gets reshaped by the one that's come since. So modernist books are obviously shaped by film and cinemas. Again, you know, if you thought about movies in 1910, would they have seemed like they were going to be the great art form of the future? One of the things I kind of like to do again is think back to, if you'd been around in 1910, there were lots and lots of discussions about what the great American art form was going to be. And people were arguing, when would the great American symphony come? When would the great American novel be written? There's lots and lots of argument about that. If anyone had told you the great American art form is going to come from really poor African Americans in Louisiana and Jewish immigrants in Southern California, that desert, right, the desert of Southern California, trying to make cheap entertainment for the masses, that those are going to be the places that the great American art forms of the 20th century are going to emerge, you would have thought that they were crazy. So I think it's very unpredictable about how those things are going to develop. And certainly our technologies will reshape our brain because our technologies have always reshaped our brains.
Or that a bookseller in Washington would become nominated and winning Emmys. Amazon just was nominated for an Oscar. It is such a swiftly changing world. I love that we have not only ended on, but so many points throughout the evening, have been talking about the books and the fine value of books here at the library. It's so fitting. I want to point everyone's attention.
Can I say one last thing about that? Which is, you know, talking, I had meant to say that before, you know, talking about these institutions that allow gardens and allow children, it can be sort of discouraging. We're not going to be foragers. We don't have villages. Our children are far away and we have to Skype with them. But it's interesting that we have things like children's museums and libraries that have taken on a lot of the work of being a community where people can bring children where children can meet each other, where parents can meet each other, where activities can take place that aren't just the kind of institutional educational ability. So I think that's a very optimistic story.
Absolutely. Speaking of which, if you have a child in your life, if you're a parent, a grandparent, an alloparent, and you have not been to the children's section here, it is like Disneyland with books. And you'll note that that picture right there, support your library. I love the fact that the image on that is someone with two kids in their lap. I want to say this place does amazing things, and now more than ever, it's time for a place like the LA Public Library. So most of you know I usually shell for money for my own public radio station when I'm here. I always want to put out the good word. If you can, please become a member of this family here at the LA Public Library, where, of course, I have a feeling you could probably check out this book as well. Allison Gopnik, thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thanks, everyone.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.